I want to thank everyone for tuning in to listen to this radio program. My name is Ian Castle. I'm a full-time microcap investor and founder of Microcap Club, and alongside me today is Mike Schellinger, also known as Mike DD King. Mike, how are you doing today?
Great, Ian. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited to have you join me today because, you know, you're not only a friend of mine, but a great full-time investor, and you'll be a great asset for this discussion today. Through the Microcap Club blog, email, or Twitter, I often get asked questions about being a full-time investor. You know, questions like, at what point in time did you know it was time to go full-time, or, you know, how much capital is needed to invest full-time? Questions like these are happen quite often. These are great questions, and I feel they deserve some attention, and not only from me, but from Mike as well. Over the course of this program, Mike and I will address a few of these questions. Although Mike and I are both full-time microcap investors, our investment approaches are quite different, which I think can be a great dynamic for this discussion with a few questions in particular. So without further ado, you know, I thought we'd just get started and get into it with our backgrounds, and I guess I'll start off first. To date me, I'm 34 years old, or actually I'll be 34 years old another week or two, and I started investing when I was a teenager, around 16, 17 years of age. My parents handed over an account to me that had around $20,000 in it when I was 16 or 17 years old, and this was basically all the money that they had saved for me through my whole life, and this was going to be used as a way to pay for my college. And they handed it over to me when I was maybe a junior in high school, just so I would know how much money I was going to receive. This was going to be, you know, all the money I was going to get to know where to apply myself or what college to apply to. And around the same time, I had been getting more and more interested in stocks, which wasn't unnormal for the time period. This was the bubble time period of the late 90s, and it was a raging bull market. I quickly decided I would go to a local university, which would be cheaper, so I could invest the $20,000 I had been given. I quickly doubled it to, I think, $55,000 or so in the course of a year, and that's not some huge feat. I mean, the late 90s, you could throw a dart at the Wall Street Journal and probably double your money in a year, so it wasn't that hard to do. When the bear market finally hit around the year 2000, the bubble burst, and I went all in on one small cap tech company in particular and started averaging down and down and down, and I quickly ended up losing 80% of this money. Luckily, I chose an inexpensive college, and my almost full-time job at the time, working for a local stockbroker, allowed me to work and pay for my tuition as I went. Around the same time, I subscribed to a couple newsletters that talked about microcaps, and microcaps really fascinated me for a few different reasons. One company in particular that caught my attention in one of these newsletters was a company called XM Satellite Radio, which is now Sirius. I know a lot of people probably have Sirius in their cars today, but back then it was actually just a microcap stock. I saw the company was presenting up at a New York City conference, so I got on a bus and went. I lied about my occupation. I drawed up some fake business cards, and I was able to actually meet with the management team. I was impressed with the conversation, so I came back home and put my last, I think it was $8,000 or so, into XM Satellite Radio at $1.78 per share. I can still remember making that trade. The stock would almost immediately go on a historic run. I think the stock went up to around $30 per share from $1.78 over around an 18-month time period. There was a massive short squeeze. My buy point was a complete luck. You know, there was no skill really involved, but it really started my love affair with microcaps. From that point forward, I wanted to invest exclusively in microcaps, and I felt the ability to meet with management was really the ultimate edge in investing. Through college and into graduate school, I started to meet with microcap management teams. I would learn by losing my money over and over again. You know, then all of a sudden, you start losing less money. I would have disastrous losers and some big winners, but that was ultimately my real education. In 2005, soon after getting my MBA, I needed to at least pay my bills, so I started an advising firm focused on microcap stocks. I knew a lot about the space, and I knew a lot of the players in the space by this point. You know, I would advise one or two companies at a time and help them navigate the capital markets. However, my ultimate goal was always to quit advising and become a full-time investor. And in late 2008, I quit advising companies and became a full-time microcap investor. We'll get into this decision a little bit more in a little bit, but you know, I tweeted the other day one of my favorite Howard Marks memos, which is about getting lucky, and I consider myself truly lucky, and maybe not the way people think. I feel I was very lucky in a couple of ways, and those two ways were the two bear markets that I had invested in. I'm about as young as you could be to have invested through the dot-com bubble, and then also obviously through 2008, 2009. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that you don't know sort of how good you are until, you know, you invest through a couple of these bear markets. Some of my experiences working for the stockbroker, I was basically a glorified secretary. And during when the bubble burst in 2000, you know, I had to answer all those phone calls, you know, around 1,200 different clients calling, complaining. I saw that irrationality. I saw the way people, their emotions affected them. And it really was a great experience for me looking back. So, you know, having invested in a couple bear markets was probably the luckiest thing that could have happened to me as an investor. With that long background out of the way, I think I'll now turn it back over to Mike to give a little bit about his background.
So my background is a bit unusual. In fact, I would say that most people that are full-time investors and traders kind of have unusual backgrounds. But I have a degree in computer engineering, which I got in 1989. And I spent most of my corporate career managing the development of software for cell phones. Sometime in the 90s, I think it was the early 90s, I started investing a little bit of money. I was in small banks. My dad was picking out the banks, so I was just following him. So I wasn't really doing a lot of picking things out, but I was learning a bit. But in the late 1990s, I had more money to invest, and I decided I wanted to start, you know, picking out stocks on my own. So I spent a fair amount of time studying things, and before I made that first trade, and given my background in technology, I kind of avoided the technology sector, luckily, because I kind of saw the irrationality that was going on when you saw these just crazy valuations that companies had. And it didn't make any sense to me, especially being in the technology sector in the work world. I kind of saw that something wasn't quite right. So I kind of did gravitate, as I was looking at companies, towards microcap companies. Probably more of a little. It was more maybe value and growth, as opposed to now I'm really more of a growth investor, but I had a bit more of a value component to it back at that time. So anyway, in 1999, I think I made the first trade on the stock of my own that I picked out, as opposed to following somebody else, went through the crash and survived. That was a bit of a learning lesson, as Ian alluded to. And I stuck with it. In 2003 through 2006, I did quite well. This started out really as a hobby, and it grew and grew and grew. And pretty soon, it was, much more than a hobby, and it was almost, approaching a full-time job. But I was still working my corporate job managing software development. So I reached a point where I realized it was not humanly possible to do both of those, at least do both of those well, and I decided I had to make a decision. And that was an easy decision because my passion was the microcap world and stocks. So in 2006, I cut the cord and went full-time and basically haven't looked back. Yeah, so that's kind of my background. Ian, what was the catalyst that made you decide to go full-time?
Well, it was funny. My years working for that stockbroker for a couple of years during the market crash taught me I didn't want to manage other people's money, whether that was being a broker or managing a fund. You know, I like networking with people, but I don't want to deal with their money. I see how it affects people. I really wanted to be a full-time private investor just managing my own account. So, you know, from 2005 to 2008 when I was doing that advising, I had more successes than failures, and I was able to build up my capital base to a decent level. Getting back to what I said earlier about being lucky to have invested through two bear markets, the 2008 market collapse really almost solidified and gave me the proof that I needed that my investment philosophy worked. In 2008 into 2009, we had, you know, probably the worst economic backdrop since the Great Depression. You know, when the markets were down over 50%, I was up 150 to 200%. And really, at that very moment, seeing all the carnage in the market and really doing fairly well in spite of it, I knew it was time to make the switch to being a full-time investor. I almost needed to do well through a bear market to prove to myself that I was ready. That was really the tipping point for me to go full-time. What do you think, Michael? I know we talked about this previously, I know even off the radio program, but how much capital do you feel is needed, you know, before you make sort of the switch over to becoming a full-time investor?
Oh, I think, you know, you have to look at that on an individual basis. And you probably, you know, first of all, I think before anybody would decide to do this full-time, they need to do it part-time for a period of time. So you're probably going to have an idea of you know, what kind of returns you've experienced. You have to be able to plan through, you know, not only the good times, but also the bad times, because the droughts can be pretty big in this business. And so I think I would kind of boil that down to, you know, figure out what your expenses are, and probably a good starting point is having enough capital so that you've got 10 times your expenses. But, you know, individual mileage is going to vary, and some people might be comfortable with less, some people might require more. So anyway, I kind of think that's the best way to approach it. How about you, Ian?
You know, my decision was sort of 90% psychological and probably much less about a specific amount, but the one area where I did focus on a specific amount was, you know, I wanted to be in a scenario when I made that decision to go full-time to where if I had a really bad year, you know, if I lost 50% of my money in a year or two, that I could still invest full-time. You know, I really didn't ever want to be in a circumstance where I had to get a job again. You know, that was like my worst nightmare. I think I'd rather live on the street than work for anybody. And so I wanted to be sure that I had enough capital aside where I could withstand, you know, a 50% down year. I'm also cognizant of the fact that I was single at the time and, you know, I could live off a very low fixed overhead. Certainly helped that as well.
Yeah. Well, definitely your life circumstances, are definitely a factor in, you know, in how you look at making this decision, and quite frankly, how you, you know, your investing style, you know, once you're involved in doing this full time, does get impacted by your life situation.
You know, kind of switching to investment style, Mike. You know, your investment style is a bit different than mine, but where we probably are very similar is the types of things that we look for, and we really are mainly trying to find cheap growth. You know, what I've found through the years is institutions can't stay away from fast-growing, profitable companies. So if we, as microcap investors, can find these companies when they're very small and buy them before any institution knows they exist, it's a good recipe for success. And it's a recipe, when put together correctly, you know, can end up yielding multi-baggers. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I really would. Yeah, I would say, you know, probably the two keys that I look for are, you know, rapidly growing profitable companies at a, you know, compelling valuation. And some of the other things I like to see are, you know, high gross margin or catalysts such as insiders buying stock or maybe some large contract. You know, it's always nice when you can find something that's kind of got an interesting story to it. It tends to get a better multiple when it's got a more interesting story. So those are some of the factors. Actually, if you want to know more about my investing style, a while back I wrote up a two-part blog series on Microcap Club entitled My Secret Recipe, which goes into a little bit more details of what I look at. So,
where Where do you seem to find the best sources of your ideas, Mike?
Well, in my style, I do a lot of reading of SEC filings and press releases. You know, that's where I spend a big chunk of my day, is just scanning through those filings and press releases to find, you know, companies that have, you know, maybe their earnings have jumped, maybe they just got a new contract, maybe there's some insider buying, some sort of key to give me, I sort of have a bottoms-up methodology. So, and that's probably, you know, I've never really done any statistics on this, but my guess is that I probably find 40 to 50% of my ideas on my own, and they're mainly found through, you know, scanning these filings and press releases.
It takes a lot of work to look through all of those filings and press releases, and kind of switching to another way that a lot of people get at our ideas, going to screens, to stock screens themselves. You know, I subscribe to probably the best screen software there is out there, and it's amazing just how many companies that screen software doesn't pick up on. And it just points back to kind of your approach of you can't replace just hard work and diligence of just going through almost every filing and press release that there is. That way you know nothing's falling through the back, so to speak.
Just talking about some other ways that we find ideas. And networking, you know, is a big way. And I think networking falls into, you know, different categories. You've got sort of the, you know, social media aspects, and then the actual, the personal networks that you put together. So, you know, networking for ideas, you know, obviously we're, you know, both from Microcap Club, and I honestly feel it's the best resource out there for people in the microcap space. But there's other social media places where you can you know, find ideas as well, and I use those quite frequently.
An area that we've always been a kind of a part of, or at least lurking, is even on the public message board circuit. You know, I think it's pretty much a fact that small retail investors find companies first, and it's important to. I think it's also important to kind of look at what's being talked about on public message boards, and even though 99.9% of it might be total garbage, you know, it's a lot of times it's still worth it because of that 0.1% that you're going to find something that you wouldn't have. And so I think public message boards are also a good place. And obviously the club, you know, having founded it a few years ago, you know, the goal of the club has been to get as many kind of smart people in one place trying to find these companies. And, you know, since 2011, I think our membership has profiled now 50 companies that have doubled or more. And that's a rate greater than one double per month. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that having 100 smart investors scouring the markets for the best companies is better than any individual or, you know, guru or service or whatever you call it. And so the club's been beneficial for us that way. Kind of switching to the positions and position sizing and the amount of positions, I think this is probably an area where you and I differ a little bit. Do you want to talk a little bit about the amount of positions you have and that type of thing?
Sure. Well, first thing I would say is, in this profession, you know, you're always constantly learning, and this is probably the place where I've been trying to constantly learn for a while. So I tend to have quite a few positions. I don't know how many I have now, maybe 20 or so. Although, you know, of the invested capital, there's probably, you know, probably the top, I would say 7 or 8 are probably, you know, 60 to 70% of the capital that's invested. So it's you know, somewhat concentrated, but not super concentrated. When I'm taking out a position, I almost never hit 10% of the portfolio in that one position. And I will manage the size of that position if it's a winner. I'm not going to let it grow to be, you know, 30, 40% of the portfolio. It's going to get trimmed as it grows, just because I think that's, you know, for me, that's a kind of a smart management approach. But I think the other thing to realize is that the number of positions and position sizing can also be a factor of, you know, your life stage and your current situation. When I first started out, you know, I probably had 5 or 6 positions, but it, you know, that, and that made sense back then because, you know, percentage of my assets, my invested capital wasn't really that big, and I had a full-time job. So if I made some mistakes, I had money coming in. So there are some things where position sizing is really impacted by your life situation.
Are you saying I'm young and naive, Michael?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Well,
no, it's just different.
No, I understand. I focus on owning, it's sort of the way I've always been, but I focus on owning the best 5, 6, 7 companies I can find, and I'll hold them for years as long as the story doesn't change. You know, for example, you know, one of the holdings I'm in, you know, I've been in since 2010, and it's up nicely, and I haven't sold a single share. Another one I've been in since 2012, another one mid-2012. So I don't mind holding things and sitting on big positions. You know, like I'm a rather concentrated investor. I think my top three positions make up about 75% to 80% of my portfolio. And in 2014, honestly, I added to all three of these top positions. In one instance, I think I bought more shares 500% higher than my initial buy from a few years earlier. So I'm not that active from a trading standpoint. You know, I rarely trade around my core positions. Looking back at 2014, you know, I think I made a total of 20 trades for the whole year. So I think it's really interesting because, you know, Mike is definitely different when it comes to this, but he's also, you know, very successful as well. Yeah, how many trades do you think you made last year, Mike?
Oh, gee, I don't know. It was probably, I'd have to go back and look, but my guess would be it's north of 1,000. So in any case,
wow.
You know, I
yeah.
don't know if that's an accurate number, but certainly much more than you.
More than 20.
Yeah. Well, but there's, you know, more than one way to make, you know,
exactly
this work.
So looking at your approach then, when do you decide to sell?
So, well, generally, first post, you know, both on buying and on selling, I scale in and scale out. So it's rarely just, you know, one day do I decide and buy my whole position, although that occasionally happens if it's the right situation, but it's generally scale in and scale out. And it's kind of based on, you know, risk-reward, P/E ratios, portfolio sizing. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. So I may sell, you know, much differently on one position than in another position. You know, sometimes there's days where I sell a whole position, you know, of a company in one day, and then there's other situations where it might, you know, I might do it over, you know, 6 or 9 months, especially if it's one that's, you know, moving up considerably. I might, you know, take some of it off just because it's gotten too big of a amount of my portfolio. So I'll, you know, start scaling out a little bit, but then, you know, sell more as it continues to move up.
I also scale into my positions when I buy. You know, earlier when I was younger, I used to just kind of barge my way into a position and buy it all at once, and it works when it works, and then it really doesn't work when it doesn't work. And it worked early on for in a couple of occasions, and it kind of gets you cocky, and then you have a couple investments where you probably should have took more of your time and let management prove themselves a little bit more to you before kind of making the plunge. So as it relates to selling, though, you know, the key for me, and I'm sure it's the same with you too, Mike, is constantly assessing the company, constantly assessing management's execution, evaluating the industry trends, conducting ongoing maintenance due diligence on your core positions. You know, my real edge is just knowing my positions better than most. This helps me with buying, withholding, and ultimately selling as well. You know, there are three main reasons why I would sell, but my general rule of thumb is as long as the management executes and the story doesn't change, I usually don't sell. But if the story does change, I'll sell it. If a stock becomes really overvalued and gets ahead of itself, you know, I will sell. And lastly, I'll sell if I feel management has lied to me. And so those are really the primary three reasons why I would sell a position. One of the other questions that was posed to us on Twitter, Mike, was hedging. Do you ever hedge your microcap long positions?
You know, I've rarely done that. I did do that a little bit during, you know, the 2008, 2009 time period. But when I did it then, it was, very short-term hedging, maybe in a matter of a few days when you saw some activity. And I think it's really hard to actually try and hedge a microcap portfolio because, there's different things that make microcap stocks move, and they will move, with the broader market. But, getting a hedge that sort of matches the, your microcaps is really hard to find.
No, I would agree. I don't think I've ever hedged any positions. I think kind of what you were getting at with your comment was, the reason I don't hedge is if you find the right microcap company or companies, they ultimately do well in almost any market environment, including bear markets. So it's, it's really all comes back to finding the right long positions to be in. And that's, I think, something that's also very unique about investing in microcaps. Next thing somebody asked us was, how do you, basically a question about evaluating management, and I can start into this one. Evaluating microcap management teams can be very tricky because most of these companies are young companies that don't have 10-year track records in a lot of cases. You're only looking at 2 or 3 years of financials, but I found other attributes outside of financials can be very helpful in determining management's ability to succeed and ultimately the stock to succeed. Seeing how a company's share structure has changed through a couple of years, seeing how a company has raised capital in the past, looking at management salaries, looking at management incentives. These can all be great clues outside of the financials themselves on management's intentions and their knowledge level of the capital markets as well. A couple other areas that I relating to management is, don't be misled by management backgrounds and just because a CEO has a great past running a large company, or working for a large division of a large company and successfully so, it doesn't mean that he or she knows how to run a small company. For me, I would much rather see entrepreneurial success, taking a company from nothing to 10, 20, 50, 100 million in revenues, I think is much more impressive because in many cases, microcaps are early stage entrepreneurial companies with limited budgets. I don't mind seeing failure in a CEO's past as well because, Mike and I will get in this later, but, failure is often the only way we learn. So what I like to do is kind of look through the resume of the management team, which usually pinpoints all their successes, and then go ahead and do a Google search, and then you can find out all their failures. So that's one thing I do. But in the end, the past only tells you what they've done in the past. What you really want to know is, will this management team execute from this point forward? And evaluating management's ability to execute happens over time by watching them execute. Many microcap management teams don't do what they say. It took me, I hit on this a little bit earlier, but it took me a while to realize it's better to stair-step into a position, letting management execution tell me when to buy. I don't mind buying higher. In fact, I hope I do. When we're hunting for multi-baggers here, it's not like I'm buying a stock because I think it's going to go up 30% in 2 years. I don't mind giving up a 50% move higher to feel confident that I can make 500% or 600% or 300% in a few years. Mean management is mandatory for me. Before I buy a significant position, I'm very involved talking to management, even going out and visiting the companies that I invest in. So that kind of tells you how serious I take the management teams. One of our members, Chip Maloney, posted a great article entitled The Art of Interviewing Management, and I would point people to that article. Chip did a fantastic job outlining kind of several techniques he uses to get the most out of his conversations with management. So I think that's a great tool for investors listening today to look to get the most out of your conversations with management.
That was a great overview, Ian, on looking at management. I also feel that evaluating management is important. I don't spend as much time on it as you do, but part of that is also because I tend to focus a little bit more on companies that, have are a little bit later stage, and sometimes we're investing, the two of us are investing in companies that are at the same stage, but I think probably a fair way of looking at our two different styles is you probably tend to be more earlier stage than I am, and I think the earlier stage the company is, the bigger the magnifying glass you need to have on management
right.
to see whether to really pull it off.
Well, especially as the position sizing, too. It's like I'm generally taking larger positions as a percentage of my portfolio and individual companies, so I need to have an extra layer of knowledge level about the company, which makes it really important to talk to management as well.
Yes, well, that's very, very good point.
You know, we were asked to share some successes and failures, and you know, talking to Michael before we kind of got on here today, I thought, you know, it's probably best just to focus on failures. You know, I think talking about failure is good. It's how you learn. And so, you know, obviously we've been somewhat successful in the past. That's why we're doing this full time. So I think Michael and I are just going to focus on some of the things we learned through some of the failures. So go ahead, Mike.
So I probably say one of the biggest areas where I've had failures is companies that turned out to be scams. It does happen in the microcap space. I've, you know, been able to steer clear of most of them, but you know, every now and then you get blindsided. And I think the one thing that I've learned from that is one common thread in a lot of companies that have turned out to be scams is there's little questions I have about their accounting where I look at something and it just doesn't seem quite right. It's not like a huge problem, but something where, you know, it kind of makes me question. I'm like, this treatment doesn't seem right, or something seems wrong about this accounting. And so, you know, my approach as I've, come to this understanding is that, you know, I'm much quicker to exit now when, I look at some accounting and it doesn't make sense. It just makes me question things a lot more. So I think that's one area of failures. The other area, I don't know that something I've started to avoid more is commodity companies. I've had some successes and some failures in there, but one of the things that I've found in that space is that predicting the direction of commodity prices is in a pay grade above me. So I tend to avoid those just because it's so hard to understand a company and the management and all the factors behind things, and then when you add commodity prices moving and really changing things, I think it just makes it a lot harder to be successful.
I agree, and I think there's some overlap in sort of the areas where you failed in the past, and certainly where I've failed in the past. My failures have always been around two primary areas. The first one is not selling quick enough when the story changes, and the second area is investing in companies where I really didn't have an edge in anything, and it's really just a loss of focus on being disciplined. You know, it's really what leads to it. I don't know if listeners remember me mentioning when I decided to be a full-time investor, the thing I did look at was be having enough capital to where I could sustain probably a 50% loss and still be a full-time investor. Well, I got tested the very first year I was a full-time investor. I was coming off the best year of my investment career. I got cocky. I started investing in some biotech companies and relied on other people's due diligence instead of my own. In a couple cases, I didn't even talk to management, which might sound insane to people that know me. And at the same exact time, I was invested in another microcap, a more traditional type of investment for me. I had acquired around 4% of this company in the open market. And all of a sudden, a few things changed, and almost immediately, the tailwind that this company was in turned into a headwind. And I was cognizant of this industry shift or this trend shift as soon as it happened, but I waited an extra month or two before I started to sell, and I took a huge loss because of that. You know, the combination of investing outside my comfort area, and similar to Mike, I kind of tend to stay away from biotech and basic material stocks, and also not selling quick enough. You know, those two things led to, I think I was down close to 45% to 50% the first year out of the gate of becoming a full-time investor, and that certainly tested me. I think the biggest thing I took away from my failures was I need to remain disciplined. You know, over time and through many failures, I've gotten better at investing in what I know and staying away from areas where I know I don't know anything. And I've gotten much better at realizing when I'm wrong quicker. The next question that we were asked was, what is the worst part about investing full-time? And why don't you tackle that one, Mike?
Yeah. Well, I think just from a, you know, there's obviously a lot of benefits, so I don't want this to, this part of the conversation to sound like it's negative, because I really enjoy what I'm doing. But probably the thing I, one of the things that I dislike most is that it can be very difficult to take a vacation. Because I still have to be engaged. The stock market isn't going to stop trading because I've decided to take a vacation and there's really nobody to take over for me. So I have to kind of keep one eye on the market while I'm trying to enjoy myself, and it's a little bit harder to enjoy myself when I'm doing that. But that's a small price to pay for the freedom and the many other benefits that I get in investing full time. What about you?
And I would agree. I think I couldn't imagine doing anything else. This is my passion, and I love waking up and just being a full-time investor, and it's really just about the autonomy of doing what you want to do. And also, the great thing about being a full-time private investor is really not having to worry about clients or other people's money. You know, there's a lot of freedom in that. The areas that are bad. The worst part about investing full time, it might be an obvious one, but that is really just paying bills. You know, selling positions on a monthly basis to pay bills is just a huge mental hurdle. Something that is hard to grasp for a lot, and you don't really realize it until you make that plunge. I'm a rather long term investor, so when I have to sell a stock to pay bills every month, it can force you to look way too much at the short term, at the month to month performance. It took me a few years of investing full-time to discipline my mind to not let these monthly drawdowns influence my long-term approach. But I still think about it a lot, and I think about it probably, every week at least. You know, this combined with just getting older, getting married, having kids, not only puts a bit more of a financial stress on you, but it's more so a psychological burden. You know, as a whole, you know, I can afford to go broke, but I can't let my family go broke, and that's something that's kind of always weighing on you, and it's very, very tough, and the stress can cripple you, and it can cripple your investment style, quite honestly, if you let it. But what has kept me in the game has been a rather disciplined approach to not only investing, but also kind of lifestyle, always living below your means, having limited debt, limiting your fixed costs, making sure your variable costs are variable. Kind of travel light, travel far, as they say. Don't go on margin. Keep your personal debt to a minimum. I wrote a blog post this year about protecting yourself from yourself, that hit on this topic a bit more, and putting money away in other more conservative investments, maybe even investments that can produce a passive income stream. And so all of these things you kind of think about once you become a full-time investor, and it's something that you sort of learn to deal with it, but it certainly doesn't get much easier even as your capital grows.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I remember when I went full time that I was kind of surprised at how much the psychological effects sort of jumped out and hit you over the head. Not having that paycheck and thinking about, well, what's going to happen in a down market. And have I protected myself enough against the down market? It turned out to be a much bigger factor than I anticipated before I went full time.
The next question we were asked was, what's our typical day look like? Mike, why don't you start into that?
Okay. Well, I guess I've never really measured it, but I probably spend maybe 2 to 3 hours a day on average reading SEC filings and press releases. Mostly it's just scanning, 30 minutes or 30 seconds on a, particular filing or press release till I find something that's interesting, and then I'll, delve more into it. I also do a lot of reading of social media, Microcap Club and Twitter and other other sources that I use. Spend a fair amount of time talking on the phone with other investors or with management. I would say the heavy research, you know, if I'm looking at a company that I think, you know, might be an interesting one to buy, I tend to do that in the evening or over the weekend. I find it's kind of hard to do that during the day when, you know, you're watching what's happening in the market and, you know, you're kind of getting hit with phone calls and all kinds of different things. So I need some time to focus when I'm really evaluating a company. So overall, I would say I probably spend 60 hours a week doing this. So it's, you know, I think most friends and you know, other people, when they find out you're going to be doing this, think, oh, you know, you're going to be out playing golf every day you know, you're retiring you know, that's not the way it is if you're going to be successful at this. It's a full-time job plus.
Yeah, that is certainly the case. My typical day is kind of a combination of following Microcap Club, looking at new ideas, ongoing maintenance, due diligence of my positions. You know, I normally get up, and this may be a little bit too much detail, but I normally get up pretty early. I usually like to read something or listen to something that kind of inspires me, whether that's a book that I'm reading or, you know, even a sermon that's online or something like that. I'm a big fan of business biographies, so I read a lot of business biographies. I like to see what made other people successful and also where they failed. And so I'm constantly reading kind of these business biographies that are out there. And I'm a big believer in starting out the day with a purpose because you'll never get that day back. So I want to start out the day inspired to really be the best I can be for that day. And I normally go right to Microcap Club to see what I missed since the previous night. You know, I'm pretty much administering the club along with Mike and a couple of others. So keeping up with the club is almost a full-time job, but it's one I love to do because it's definitely a good source of ideas. I spend an hour or more each day on maintenance due diligence of my current positions. I'm a very high-contact investor, and what I mean by that is I normally talk to the CEOs of the companies I'm invested in regularly, some once per month, some once per week. You know, it really depends. This isn't something that most new investors that, you know, are listening to this radio program can expect to do. It's just something that happens, you know, as you kind of become a larger investor and you start to gain a CEO's respect. They look to you for certain advice with certain things, and it's something that I really enjoy doing. It's kind of being a high-contact investor. Also try to work out every day for an hour or so in the middle of the day usually. Just to break up the day. It's not healthy just to sit and stare at the computer screen for 12 hours in a row. So I like to get out there and keep my body active, which also keeps, you know, my mind active as well. One thing new for 2015, you know, again, my investment approach is a little bit different than Mike's, but, you know, one thing I'm trying to do is actually not look at the market as much as I have in the past. You know, I'm a fairly long-term investor. And so, you know, in the past, you know, just kind of looking out the corner of my eye and looking at what the stocks are doing on a minute-to-minute basis, you know, it's almost addicting, but it's not necessary with my investment approach. So I've kind of started turning off the brokerage screen, you know, maybe looking at quotes maybe once an hour instead of once every 2 minutes. And it's amazing just in these first few days of 2015 how much more productive I've been. And so I'm always looking to become more efficient with my time, which I think also helps you be a better investor as well. Mike, what keeps you going?
Well, I would say probably two things.
Greed? No, I'm just kidding.
No, not really. The challenge of finding the next win. You know, when you find that you know the company that you know becomes a 10-bagger. That's really exciting, and it's always a challenge of, you know, where can I find that next one? What, you know, where will that be? How can I go about identifying it? And sort of combined with that is the constant learning. You know, I think the two of us are pretty similar in that we'll look at just about any industry. And there's always something new to learn about, you know, the food industry or, you know, some entertainment industry or, you know, some medical industry or what have you. And you know, I think that's, you know, if I were focused on one sector, you know, and just learning about that sector, I think I might get bored. But you know, the challenge of learning about a variety of different things really keeps it interesting and fresh. And I think that's what keeps me going and you know, helps to make it exciting every day when I get up and start working on it, is that, you know, there is something new to learn. There's a new challenge. It's not the same old, same old. So that's what keeps me going. How about you, Ian?
No, I think you raised a couple of really good points. I mean, I think just trying to find the next great company is very addicting, you know, and also I find the due diligence process, once you think you found the next great company, to be very addicting. You know, it's fun educating yourself in these certain areas, just like what you said as well. You know, I also enjoy just talking and networking with other investors. We hit on this a little bit earlier in the conversation, but I enjoy talking with the next generation of passionate microcap investors, and letting them know, you know, what is possible. You know, a lot of people, I think, look up to Mike and also myself and think, okay, well, you know, this is what we can be. And I think it's important for, you know, Mike and I to be kind of good role models out there and kind of teach them how, not necessarily how exactly we do what we do, because we want to still be able to do what we do and do it well. We don't want to make it too efficient. But just letting them know that, you know, a lot of the things that they've gone through, whether that's failure or whatnot, you know, is something that all of us have gone through. I tweet out every month or so this great quote from a pastor named Craig Rochelle, but he says that we may impress people with our strengths, but we connect with people through our weaknesses. And I think that statement is very true with life and also with investing. You know, I'm not an infallible person or investor, and I'll make mistakes, and Mike will too. And we're certainly going to lose money from time to time, but we can always learn from each other.
Absolutely. You know, and you kind of hit on something that we've been talking throughout this whole thing that I know we had a question on, and that was networking. And one of the things I'll say about this business is that, you know, I think most people on the outside, you know, see you're going to do that, and they envision you sitting in front of a computer all day and, you know, never talking with a soul, and you know, and it's really actually, you know, I probably talk just as much to people as I did when I was in my corporate job, you know, now as an investor, because there's always management teams to talk to, investors to talk with, and, you know, we're going to investor conferences. We have microcap club meetups. We're talking with people online through various social media aspects. So there's really a lot of communication that goes on. So it's not a solo activity like most people think.
Yeah, you don't just sit at your desk all day for 12 hours in solitude.
Yeah, kill me if I did that.
Oh, I agree. It would drive me insane. But I think that's a good place to leave it. I hope everyone that's listening gets some value out of the program today, and we'll certainly look to perhaps doing more on this subject and other subjects in the future.